Chapter 1. Live from New York. Maybe it was predictable that my struggle over the LGBTQ issue would finally become unbearable in New York City, where the gay rights movement started. I was in the Big Apple in 2013 for one of those off-the-record, invitation-only confabs that make people feel really important. The host was one of America's hottest young evangelical, theologically conservative Protestant Christian leaders. This talented young man had invited about a dozen, mainly 20 and 30-something evangelical up-and-comers, and a few oldsters like me, recently having reached the shocking age of 50, to come to a conference room in Manhattan for a one-day meeting to talk together about our work and dreams. I remember almost nothing of what was said at the meeting, other than the numerous offhand comments along the way about the LGBTQ issue and its relation to evangelical Christianity. This is not at all uncommon. You can't turn around these days in Christian circles without bumping into the gay issue. It has become the hottest of all hot potatoes in evangelical Christianity, as it has in much of U.S. and global culture. It has a particular twist these days among young, hip, and often urban evangelicals. Such evangelicals, with their skinny jeans and cafe macchiatos, under no circumstances want to be like or to sound like their oh-so-square evangelical forebears of the previous generation. They do not want to sound hateful, they do not want to be demagogues, and they do not want to be confused with Christian rightists like ye old Jerry Falwell. And they really want to share the gospel effectively in big, sophisticated urban centers like New York. Such young evangelical movers and shakers are caught between two very powerful forces in their own religious subculture. On the one hand, older leaders in their world still hold extraordinary power to open or close doors to younger evangelicals who are climbing their career ladders in the religion business. These older leaders are almost unanimously closed to any reconsideration of this issue, and so far they have the power to exclude anyone who might even want to open that conversation. For many evangelicals, this makes fresh thinking literally unthinkable. On the other hand, well-informed 30-something evangelicals are plenty aware of dissent bubbling up from their younger co-religionists. They know that the evangelical consensus is not fully persuading the youth group kids and Christian college students who populate our grassroots. Many of these kids have made clear to pollsters and anyone else who is listening that they find the traditional Christian treatment of and views about gays and lesbians a problem for their faith and for their relationships with people they care about, including gay and lesbian friends. Many are leaving the church, or at least evangelicalism, over the LGBTQ issue. According to Public Religion Research, 70% of America's most unchurched generation, the millennials, say that religious groups are alienating young people by being too judgmental about gay and lesbian issues. And 31% of those millennials who have left the church say this was an important factor in why they left. Most younger Christians and ex-Christians have not come up with a biblical or theological alternative to the traditionalist position. But they are not satisfied at all with the status quo. And they sure want to be able to talk about the LGBTQ issue in some fresh ways and in open, uncensored spaces. Anyone who works with young Christians has encountered these concerns. Maybe what finally sent me over the edge at this particular meeting was that I didn't expect us to be talking about the LGBTQ issue. It wasn't on the agenda. But when first mentioned, I thought, for a hopeful nanosecond, that maybe I might hear some fresh ideas among these promising young leaders. But it was not to be. They mainly nodded sagely at each other as they passed around the same well-worn cliches that I have heard 1,000 times. And so everyone emerged into the night air of New York City, agreeing that they needed to keep fighting the good Christian fight against the liberals and the gays, no matter how incomprehensible this view might be to most everyone else on those Manhattan streets. Everyone agreed, except me. I had found the gay parts of the conversation insufferable. It was fully clear to me at last that my mind had changed decisively on several aspects of this issue. I could no longer endure such conversations in silence, and I could not remain identified as an evangelical, or especially as an evangelical moral leader, if that meant an assumption that I shared the evangelical consensus on this issue. It was time to go public with some fresh thinking. This is news, if you know anything about evangelicalism, America's leading religious community by population, and an increasingly powerful force in global culture. This religious community all around the world, think about some of the hateful legislation being advanced by evangelicals in Africa, for example, has almost unequivocally positioned itself as an opponent of gay rights and the gay community, and certainly as an opponent of any rethinking of traditional Christian sexual ethics in relation to gays and lesbians. I myself have preached, lectured, and written, politely, but still I am on the record, in defense of the traditional evangelical position on these issues for as long as I have served as a Christian minister, 27 years, and ethicist, 21 years. I have stood before thousands of college and seminary students as a preacher and professor. I co-wrote perhaps the leading evangelical Christian ethics textbook, Kingdom Ethics, which is read in 9 languages around the world, and in its first edition took the traditional position. Tens of thousands of Christians have read my words. This has not been a hobby horse issue for me. I have not traveled the country railing against the homosexual lifestyle or the gay lobby. I have consistently attacked homophobia and called for Christian compassion. But I have said that there can be no moral acceptance of gay and lesbian sexual relationships. Until very recently, I had not written a word in favor of the full inclusion of gay and lesbian Christians in the church. My adherence to the party line on this issue helped me have access to the leading evangelical colleges, seminaries, magazines, publishing houses, and high-level Manhattan meetings that have been my privilege for 2 decades. I would name these connections to impress you with the extent to which I am deeply burrowed into the leading circles of my religious community, but, well, that would be insufferable in its own way, don't you think? Check me out at www.davidpgushy.com, or just take my word for it. It certainly feels great to be a leader in one's profession, and the perks are nice too, including the travel, the royalties, and the sometimes quite comfortable hotel suites. And there's a special pride associated with being not just a leader, but a religious leader. Such pride is very dangerous, though I can recognize it in myself and can see how it kept me quiet and still keeps many others from rocking the religious boat. But that is what I must now do. Now I have something different to say. My mind has changed. This book is partly about the process through which my mind has changed, and partly about how I see biblical truth now that my mind has changed. In one sense, it's a personal narrative. In another sense, it's a statement of biblical theology as I see it now. I have been led on a journey that has put me in a very different place from where I started. It is only fair that everyone who has ever trusted what I wrote about this issue or any other issue in the past should be shown how it is that my mind has changed on this particular issue now. Any other interested person is warmly invited to listen in. This book will describe how I have come to break with the evangelical consensus represented in that Manhattan meeting room. It is the story, especially, of how not the Bible itself, but traditionalist readings of certain texts in the Bible have become increasingly implausible to me, while other texts about the gospel message and the church now seem to have a broader range of application, broad enough to include the full embrace of gays and lesbians. My mind has changed, especially due to the transformative encounters I have been blessed to have with gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender Christians over the last decade. One of them is my own beloved sister, who is dearer to me than words can say, and who came out as a lesbian not long ago. Others are fellow church members. Some have been my students. Some were strangers who came looking for me and asking for a conversation by email, phone, or over coffee. As with straight Christians, the romantic, sexual lives of these LGBTQ Christians vary. Some are celibate, some are not. Some are seeking relationships, and some are not. Some believe same-sex relationships might be okay with God, and some do not. Some are in covenant partnerships, and some are not. Some are parents, and some are not. I have learned from their great diversity never again to accept ill-informed statements about the homosexual lifestyle. The faith journeys and perspectives of these Christian friends vary in the same way. Some are liberal, and some are conservative. Some are high church, and some are low church. Some like hymns, and some like praise choruses. They are just Christian people, in all of their maddening and lovable diversity. Currently, the most evangelistic friend I have is a gay Christian brother. He's always out there sharing his faith. Another gay Christian friend is into pop apocalyptic writings like the Left Behind series, which I personally loathe. And I have never seen a bigger collection of conservative Christian books than in the library of another gay Christian friend. When you actually allow gay and lesbian people into your life as a Christian, you are in for some surprises. I did not go looking for these new friends, these experiences, and encounters. They have come to me. I now believe that they have been sent to me. In my spiritual tradition, unexpected breakthroughs in Christian community are not viewed as accidental. They are more often described as the work of the Holy Spirit of God. My mind and heart have changed as God has sent large numbers of sexual others into my life. These experiences have gradually led to a sharpening of my understanding of the Christian gospel and the Christian church, and some fresh thinking about what Christian sexual ethics should look like. I feel obligated before God and these new Christian friends of mine both to show you and tell you about this change, and in all gentleness, to ask you to consider joining me on such a journey yourself. What follows is not an exhaustive work. After various false starts, I decided that the best way to address this subject was a series of short, timely chapters that anyone could read in relatively brief chunks of time. To use an older parallel, this is more like a collection of anti-slavery pamphlets than a ponderous scholarly tome. That is exactly how this collection was originally published as a series of essays. It is truly amazing how much scholarly ink has been spilled among specialists on parsing the finest details of Hebrew and Greek words and documents that might be relevant to this issue. No wonder lay people are confused and don't know what to think. I hope that what I offer here will offer any reader fair-minded access to the main points of the scholarly discussion. But more importantly, I hope that at every point I direct attention to what is most deeply at stake. That is the Church's effort to discern what it means to follow Jesus in every area of life, including in our sexual ethics, and in the way we treat sexual minorities in the body of Christ.